Hello and welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Hans, editor of Innovation Map. My guest for today is Sahir Ali, founder and general partner of Modi Ventures, a new investment firm focused on the intersection of data and AI and health tech innovation. Sahir joins the show today to discuss how his firm operates a little bit differently from traditional VC entities, as well as how he's raised an oversubscribed $32 million initial fund in less than a month. Sahir, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm excited to really dive into Modi Ventures and everything. But before we start talking about your first fund with the new firm, tell me about your background, which spans research, tech, and now, you know, investment. So share a little bit about your background.
Yes, I'm actually from Houston, but when I was in just in the high school days, I was very really involved with computers, and I became a pretty full-fledged C++ programmer in early 2000s when I was only 14, and which led me to shadow engineers at NASA. And that led me, in fact, it was those days where I got introduced to artificial intelligence, computer vision that early on. And so for a bit, I put that on hold. And when I ended up at Rutgers, one of my goals were to be in Wall Street. And so because I was good at computer science, math and science, the typical, I kind of went and pursued the quantitative world at Wall Street. So I became a quant intern as well at Wall Street at a pretty high profile fund. And during those days, the markets crashed. In 2008, financial crisis happened. And so two things that happened to me. One was that while everyone else was sort of reeling from that, I got hired as a full-time undergrad at Wall Street. So that was fantastic personally to me, of course, not so much for everybody else. But the second thing was made me realize that this is not the space I want to be in, although it paid probably the best, even better than tech at the time out there. So it allowed me to kind of start looking at other things. And so really it was around that time where I started to look around, what is some other field that is also could be quantitative, but a little bit ahead of its time. And this is how I ended up in kind of oncology and artificial intelligence intersection right around 2010-ish, towards the end of my undergrad, which ultimately led to my master's and did my PhD work in that space. I ended up giving a TEDx on that topic, if anybody's interested, around 2017, called AI versus Pathologist. And during that time, I also picked up Salesforce. So this is where the tech part was parallel going to. For me at Wall Street, I got introduced to a technology called Salesforce.com very early on. And I ended up becoming one of the youngest architects in the world of Salesforce. And so I worked with Fortune 100 companies in laying out their billion-dollar pipelines of sales and marketing. And then eventually I started incorporating artificial intelligence. I was one of the few architects in the world who could actually do that. And so I've seen the enterprise tech, I've seen the sort of research world. And I've also, my brother, we've been involved with a couple of entrepreneurial companies as well. So I've had some exits from there. So I guess I've had this parallel thing going on, which kind of came together when this idea of a fund came around, which we can double click later. So that's in a nutshell my last decade or so.
Yeah, great. Well, that takes us up to Modi Ventures. And yes, you've set the scene. Now tell us that moment of inspiration you wanted to start this fund. Was it always something you wanted to do? Or yeah, describe the fund for us.
I don't know if I always wanted to be a fund manager. I'll start with that. You know, with being early in a lot of these technologies I mentioned to you, has always been the key for me. The curiosity has always led me to that. You know, computer vision and sort of machine learning, early 2000s, is just in my teens, was kind of asymmetrical at the time. And then getting into the Wall Street, the quantitative world was also a bit kind of, I wouldn't say ahead of time, but very small world. Then Salesforce.com, the cloud, sort of the crowd revolution. I was kind of at the early days of that. And then we're talking about the intersection of AI and kind of the medical imaging and the oncology. Again, it was kind of early days. And so I would say that what has been part of my success and was driven a lot of my professional growth and scientific growth and also financial growth, I should identify that as well, has been a bit ahead of the curve a little bit in technologies. And so that is really the basis of the fund is, and if you look at everything that's kind of come together, the thesis that I think I started to think about is that you have come to a point where hardware and software have accelerated to a point where now artificial intelligence is raring to go. But then I think the biggest benefactor of that is going to be healthcare and the health and medicine space. And that space is not easy for some investors to just jump in right away. And so if you look at my background and being, so I think this is one of those, again, the areas where it becomes an investable decade for us. And so as others call it, the century of biology, I think this is that decade that kind of really leapfrogged that. So I think that that's kind of what motivated me. And the second thing is more macroeconomics. We are, my brother and I, we've turned ourselves into a single family office as well. So we have done multiple investments. This is not, the private markets are not new to us. But in a sense that, you know, when we start to kind of attract external capital, the macroeconomics was also pretty good coming into this sort of December last year. What had happened is in 2022, there was an 81% decline in total funding available in venture capital funds. In fact, you had almost 34% less funds being closed from the year before. One of the most kind of telling thing for me was that there were almost uptake of about 25-28% on $1 billion funds being closing versus last year. And so what that told me is investors are looking to go towards safer routes, funds that are quite established. And so emerging fund managers are going to have a really tough time closing their funds. And the last thing was that interest rates were high. And so the only way you can close a fund and you're a new entrant or first-time fund manager, you had to be completely value-aligned with investors. And so based on all of these metrics, we came up with a strategy, which is not entirely VC. It's not entirely private equity. It's kind of a private fund model, which I'll tell you in a bit. And this is how Modi Ventures, which is the venture arm under our family office, came together in December of last year.
I think that's something that I took out of like learning about Modi Ventures at first. It's you're doing something different. So yeah, explain that formula. And then I also am interested in kind of the thesis that you're working on and the types of companies you're working with. But yeah, let's start with the structure, because I think that's also interesting, to, you know, bridging the gap between these two types of funding.
Right. Well, when I see Houston market and when I see Texas in general, you will not see a lot of funds or fund managers come and raise in Houston. That's just a known fact. If funds do come to fundraise, they come in a small circle and they leave. It's not the New York, it's not the California where folks do go after a lot of LPs. And the reason is, I think in Houston, there are folks who have the appetite, but they're kind of hard to reach. And a lot of the folks here, especially high net worth and some family offices, have a lot of really good investments to do in other asset class where they don't have to have so much illiquidity and things like that. And so the structure that I think made sense for Houston was, well, first had to be about access. It had to be unparalleled, unprecedented access that just wasn't available sitting in sort of Houston and Texas in overall. And so for someone like me who has a lot of technical background, deep networks, which is very important, and my own capital deploy, one of the things I think I could bring to the table was, hey, how do we go after some of the things that we just don't have access to first? Second, that unique thesis around what's the next frontier at the intersection of AI and health and medicine, particularly. And so the structure was that I think the way to solve for a lot of these access points is, how about we become LPs in some of the hard to go after funds? Funds that are typically open to only institutional investors. What I mean by that is pension funds, endowment funds, some very large family offices. And these funds have to be focused on artificial intelligence, and a good portion has to be health, medicine, digital health, tech, bio, and things like that. And how do I bring that to the table? It's based on my deep relationships. And so as you saw, we became LPs in Khosla Ventures, which is one of the top tier funds. They're 20, you know, a good chunk of their portfolio now is digital health therapeutics. They're always been big believers in artificial intelligence. In fact, they've invested in OpenAI much ahead of than anybody else. In fact, even before Microsoft, even though Khosla is a legendary investor and technologist. And then Draper Associates, you know, Tim Draper is an iconic investor going all the way back to Hotmail days. His first investment those days was Hotmail. His father and grandfathers were the pioneers of VC world. And so, you know, we went after a fund called Artist Ventures. Their entire fund is in a new thesis called Tech Bio, which is not biotech, but Tech Bio, where these companies operate like tech companies and they go after platforms rather than a single assay, which is very, very, you know, difficult and very risky. And so that's also part of our goal, bigger thesis, by the way, Tech Bio, this thesis of Tech Bio. And then we also invested in a company called, fund called Antler, which is a global kind of Y Combinator where they operate in 20 companies. You know, if you look at the data, United States produces obviously healthy amounts of unicorns, which is, you know, the gold standard. There are countries like India and Brazil and other places that are also producing massive amounts of unicorns and technology startups. How do you get access to those? Antler provides that. And so the strategy that I just want to complete that is becoming LP in these funds also allows us direct access to some of these companies, which otherwise would be very difficult for just a small fund to kind of go after. And so we can co-invest alongside that. And then one chunk of the fund is then a typical venture capitalist where we go directly invest in the companies. We take positions, we think about reserves, we think about how are we going to maintain positions. We even do lead investments and things like that. And so that in that strategy, what it tells to investors first is that one part of our money goes into very established fund, which typically are open to very, very large fund of funds or pension funds and endowment. Second part is that we can also kind of risk adjust some of the investment, direct investments we can do because we can piggyback sometimes on some of the deep diligence some of these companies are doing, funds are doing. In fact, you know, we are co-investing in some of the companies we can't talk about now because we're just going through closing. They came directly from these funds and not SPVs, but direct cap table access, right? And the lastly, which I won't disclose the details of that, but the fee structure is completely value aligned to investors. It's a very different structure in the sense that I, as a fund manager, is incentivized to produce the results. And so my upside primarily comes from when the fund does well in terms of producing results. So that has been pretty attractive as well, which is why we actually closed this within a month.
Well, I definitely want to talk about your raise process, because I do think that's also a little different from what you traditionally see. What's so interesting to me, because, you know, I've covered fund of funds, and I've covered more traditional VC funds, and this idea that you're both is really cool. So I don't know what you can tell us about your limited partners, but who is most interested in working with you and investing in what you're doing? And you can be as specific or as vague as you want.
Yes. So first, let's start with I was the first LP in the fund. And so I have a big skin in the game than typically fund managers will see. So let's start with that. You know, you have to drink your own Kool-Aid, as I say. I don't think that should be. So also, let me also clarify. I don't think that should be the criteria for fund managers, because, you know, there are great fund managers who don't have the liquidity or the capital. But it is always good to see skin in the game. That indicates something. And it's, if it's more than what the average is, it indicates a lot to the investor. So let's start with that. The typical LPs that we have are high net worth individuals and family offices here, mostly in Houston, Austin, San Antonio. These are folks who've done very well in various sectors, from hospitality to retail to even technology. But the thesis is compelling. Is that okay? I think if the next big frontier is in health and medicine, where I think the acceleration of everything from medicine to healthcare delivery to consumer products, in fact, consumer products that are coming to bedside, how do we become part of that, which traditionally you don't have access to being in Houston. Now, of course, a lot of these folks have had access to funds before this, but they didn't see them being aligned as a value aligned, which is in their backyard now, and someone they can deeply associate with and have seen in prior circles. So I think it's been part of the trust, the partnership, which I think is value aligned. And the third is this unique model of being risk averse and risk adjusted than just being purely VC, which, you know, operates primarily on power law. You know, most portfolios will fail, few will give you big hits. And so I think these three or four factors kind of attracted these LPs, but I would say primarily the LPs range from high net worth individuals to family offices to, in fact, an institution as well, but primarily just focused on folks who are around Houston, Austin, San Antonio. So it's purely Texas-based LP base, yeah.
Very interesting. Let's talk about the first fund. It was an oversubscribed $32 million fund, and you raised it in a month, which I think would shock a lot of people, just knowing the
market conditions
we've had. Yeah. So tell me about that process. And yeah.
Well, the process is, you know, I think before this fund, I was pitched by many funds myself, right? Because as a family office, you are pitched with various sort of investments, asset classes. And the thing that I noticed about a lot of the funds that were pitching to me as a potential LP is that there's, I think, a lot of vagaries and black box effect that operates in venture capital world. It's not as simple. I think even if you look at how the funds will display their sort of metrics, it's not clear. Some will go focus on IRR. Some will focus on TVPI, which is, you know, total value paid in capital. Some will focus on DPI. It's these things that make it very opaque. And so a lot of folks who are not sort of endowments and pension funds, it's just not too attractive. So my process was, well, first of all, can I also incorporate a bit of transparency and educational? I think if in my presentations, I did start off with this pie chart, which actually has a telling story of what's happened in venture capital in the last 10 years, that 50% of the VC funds do not return money. I actually started with that. That then the other 25% will return less than 2x, which if you were to think about the hold period of 10 years, you're better off just putting it into an index on NASDAQ, and, you know, you'll still be the same return, and you don't have to suffer the illiquidity. And so you kind of start with the transparency. You start to showcase how you actually risk adjust that. And then the strategy I already told you, that I think start to be in funds that you drive the sources for some of the investments for you is a lot more risk averse than just going after a lot of this pre-seed and seed, which obviously have an upside, but also have a very risk, high risks. And this also gives you a prominent place with investors like Khosla and Artis. And by the way, we're also in a fund called Section 32, which has been around for about 6-7 years and was started by folks who started Google X under Sergey Brin. Right. So these are some other folks. And one thing I also want to mention is you may have picked up on a story 2 weeks ago that Steve Jobs' son, Reed Jobs, launched an oncology focused fund called Yosemite. And it was a very stealth fund. Not many folks knew that he was out raising, and we became one of the LPs in that fund as well. So now we have arms into oncology. We have arms into digital health, in tech bio AI discovery. We're into investor of OpenAI, which is Khosla. We are looking at globally through Antler. So you can imagine, this was my presentation, that, hey, from Houston, small shop fund, we could have arms into the biggest and greatest setups, which is all kind of distilling down to what AI can do in the space of health and medicine. So that, I think, then in itself was compelling. And then folks saw that I had quite a big stake in this, and the fee structure was completely value aligned with investors. And so I think that's how you do it. I think how you do it in a month, I think that's how you do it.
Let's talk about this kind of industry that you're tapping into, because I know a lot of people have heard of biotech, but maybe not tech bio. And so Maybe let's start with that and in the simplest terms, kind of differentiate for us and describe your, I guess, thesis on when it comes to like the specific industry you're investing in.
I think it's an interesting question. TechBio has started with various definitions, but it has converged towards one definition, but I have my own. So what I'll give you is what I think if you actually mention TechBio, not many will be able to tell you what that is. It's because it's in new days. But TechBio really is, the model's flipped. What is a traditional biotech? A traditional biotech is someone found a sort of a binding or a drug or composition, and it's very useful for a particular disease indication. So they'll pursue that and go through various rigorous studies, get into human study, raise capital. Sometimes private equities will come in, and eventually either there's partnerships, upfront payments, or outright acquisitions or IPOs of a typical biotech. But it's all based around a single sort of asset, right? At any point, a bad study or something that, you know, if it's not efficacious or toxicity could just kill the whole thing. And this entire life cycle could take 14 years, 15 years. That's traditionally a biotech. In between, of course, there could be acquisitions. TechBio is kind of the flip of this model. It's saying that, well, how do we actually make this the entire process operate like a technology company? So instead of an asset, single asset, can we actually do a platform play? And so the example would be AI drug. So one of the ones, the definition of tech bio that's converged towards is some parts AI drug discovery, AI drug design, where instead of focusing on a single asset, you could design a platform that finds multiple. And the, you know, the multiple goes on shot, the term. And the example of that would be Recursion, Benevolent, you know, in silico medicine. These are massive companies with massive fundings. They're discovering drugs and kind of these structures that typically would be in someone's entire PhD or postdoctorate. They're able to find that within a month or 2 weeks because of the artificial intelligence platform. So that's kind of what TechBio as an industry has kind of converged towards. And another example would be, I think in my mind, Moderna was a TechBio company in many ways. Why? Because instead of a single asset, they were a platform company. They took mRNA, licensed it, and said, look, we're creating a technology platform to deliver mRNA for various things we could do, right? So one delivery mechanism could be for infections through vaccines. One is targeted towards the oncology therapeutics. The other was designer vaccines, which, you know, as you know, was approved not too long ago. And within 7 or 8 years of their Series A, they were out as IPO at $8 billion. Technologies companies operate in that manner, where they did not have an FDA-approved product yet. And of course, luckily for them, with NIH, they did deliver the COVID vaccines, which, you know, ultimately ended up saving a lot of lives. So that's a platform play. So anytime you have a platform play, that's TechBio. I like to extend that definition a little bit, is that that's not the only area where TechBio is. You can think about TechBio, this flip of biotech into AI and oncology, where you have this risk stratification tools that can look at massive amounts of data that just human eye or humans is not possible. So for example, disease is present at different data length scales. You have, say for example, a cancer patient goes through this workflow of medical imaging. You have either radiology or pathology. These are three-dimensional views of the tumor, two-dimensional sections in pathology. And then you have genomics analysis, then you have the proteomics analysis. It's this level of data, and then each level, there's a human looking at it in the silo. How do we collapse that? How do we create a unique signature of that tumor and then do something called precision medicine? To me, this is also TechBio, where you flip the model of diagnostic and prognostic tools that go through a long cycle where AI can flip that. The other part of TechBio to me would be digital health, that is consumer end. You know, so for example, Oura Rings of the world, you know, if you wanted to understand the sleep cycles prior to this, you needed some complicated sleep studies and all. And yes, Oura is in early days, but it has come to bedside where it is on the fingertips, so to speak. Similarly with cardiovascular events, with wearables. And so I think that all is, to me, that's kind of the bigger thesis of TechBio. But traditional definition is AI drug discovery. Also, I want to add one more thing. It's not only private investors. In fact, big corporations have been looking at this space very uniquely, but hasn't been synthesized. So take for example, before OpenAI, prior to OpenAI investment, Microsoft's largest investment in a number of years was a company called Nuance, right? Nuance Communication, which some of the listeners will recognize. Nuance used to make this speech dictation software called Dragon. So you could just speech. Now, Microsoft paid, I think, $7 or $8 billion for Nuance. And you imagine, why would Microsoft pay $7 billion for a sort of a clunky speech dictation thing where Microsoft itself has a pretty advanced technology in itself? And turns out Nuance's single most highest customer base is radiologists. 500,000 or so radiologists use Nuance to dictate their radiology report instead of typing it. And so it has great ontology built in. And so you can imagine Microsoft has been, for the last few years, have been trying to get into hospitals as a cloud vendor, and they're trying to go after this space of medical record processing and precision medicine, personalized medicine. They've had this angle for a while, and Nuance gets there. So huge acquisition just with that angle. If you look at Oracle, which is a big tech enterprise company, which primarily is concerned with back-end operation, ERP and such, their largest acquisition in a number of years was this EMR software or EHR software called Cerner, which is a big competitor to Epic. Why would Oracle go and acquire Cerner? For obvious reasons, because it is a tech solution to hospitals. But if you look at Larry Page, his interview said that we have aims to become the operating system of precision medicine. And that's how they, you know, they get arms into hospitals. Yeah, you can go down the chain of things. In fact, you have, if you look at Elon Musk, his third biggest portfolio company is Neuralink, which is, to me, is a tech bio company. It's flipping the model on how to actually have high fidelity data in and out of the brain. If you look at Jeff Bezos, they've put in billions of dollars in medical setup. One Medical was a huge acquisition. They have an entire cloud called Multiomics Cloud, where they can process genomics and all of that. So just some examples. It's not just private funds and investors, but big corporates are hugely invested in this space as well.
It's fascinating how that M&A and activity can really paint a picture. So let's talk about, you know, obviously you have the kind of fund to fund sides, but you have made some investments in some startups, one of them a Houston startup. So tell us a little bit about your startup portfolio, the types of technology these companies are targeting, and, you know, what else within tech bio you're keeping an eye on.
I would say that tech bio is the primary goal, but we are keeping an eye out for traditional, just general AI setup as well. And so before I get into our core investments, I will mention an investment of ours called Flawless AI. And so this is a company that was named as top 100 innovative innovations that Time Magazine comes out every year in their cover. So in 2021, Flawless was named as one of the 100 most innovative, 100 innovations that year. What Flawless does, before this whole generative AI blew up, you know, in the last 6 to 8 months, they were ahead of the curve, where they recognized that in Hollywood, post-production is where most of the cost is. And post-production means lip sync correcting. So if you have a rated R movie, and if you want to put that into PG-13 channels, they have to redub some of those things where they either change the, you know, the curse words to more mellow and things like that. Well, could generative AI do that with lip sync correction, where it's automatically taking care of that? The second biggest problem is dubbing. Dubbing creates a bad experience where Tom Hanks dubbed in Spanish just doesn't sound good. It's a cognitive dissonance. Can generative AI play a role? So they've been doing this for the last 2 or 3 years, and they were ahead of the curve, and not just software, but they've integrated this with the hardware stack that the movie producers use. And in fact, one of the co-founders is one of the directors of Hollywood. And they have a couple of movies that have come out. In fact, they went very viral on Twitter, where they had this clip where Tom Hanks was speaking 7 languages and and his lip sync was correct all through the software. So that was a pretty exciting investment for us. We made that investment. And the reason is it kind of goes beyond the hype cycle, because it's not just software play. It's not just an API call to OpenAI. There's real moat in terms of the domain expertise the connection, the sort of integrations with the hardware stack that Hollywood uses. And third, they've had some contracts already with that. So that just the general AI investment that I think was pretty exciting. On the three investments we've made on the health and medicine side, one is a Houston company, Houston-based Y Combinator backed company called Starling Medicine. And you know, I think I'm very bullish on sort of technology digitizing our biomedical data. I think we have tons of biomedical data floating in our own body, which allows us to be very precise about what's happening to us. I think for hundreds of years now, medicine's been practiced by outward symptoms and just experience of the physician. I think what Starling Medicine is doing is kind of moving in the direction is, can we be very precise and do not only just precise, but can we have continuous monitoring even when the patient leaves the 15-minute window of an appointment? And so what they're targeting is sort of the urine-based detector, right? So this device sort of plugs into any toilet in most homes, and it would monitor the flow and turn that into a quantitative streams of data that could be sort of pinged over the cloud to the provider, and they could be continuously monitored. And so some of those indications here are for kidney disorders, high-risk pregnancies, from a urology perspective for folks who are under the prostate screening and at high-risk prostate cancer. And so these are things that require monitoring, but can only be done when a person goes to a clinic. So this brings that sort of capability into the bathroom at the home. And so this is a pretty pretty exciting avenue. And I think I'm very bullish on this kind of digital health that comes into. And one of the more exciting things about Alex and Starling Medicine is that they've got FDA approval on this. And the business model is also very exciting, where they've thought about how the reimbursements work. And so it's always good to see that in founders who not only get excited about the technology, but as you know, health and medicine, especially healthcare, is a it's a crazy setup here. And so you have to always start with the question, cool, I have a very good technology, but who's going to pay for it? And so it's good to see how they've kind of tackled that part. The second one is a company called Lapsi Health. It's a company out of Amsterdam, which has been backed by European Commission $1 million grant, and someone who designed the Oura Ring is on their team, and they're going after this sort of question. They're kind of very stealth mode, so I will not disclose a lot more, but I'll pose this: what they're going after is that if you look at medicine and health, primarily, a lot of things are digitized. So X-rays are digitized, MRI scans are digitized. Even the blood work is now available in digital portal, right? Their APIs no longer need to be faxed around. Your blood pressure, all of those things are digitized. You know, one of the things that hasn't been really digitized that doctors do that as the first sort of step in diagnosis is auscultation, hearing the heart sound through the stethoscope. Hearing the sounds of the lungs, very important for inflammation, infections, heart sounds, obviously very important to see if the heart, and that's most physicians do auscultate patients, yet there's no record of it. It's not digitized. There are other very interesting sounds in our bodies, you know, gastro sounds, the pregnancy sounds, the fetal heart rate. So this entire space of sort of auscultatory sounds, they're becoming a platform of that. They want to introduce a series of devices that either go to physicians or to the consumer. So that's a very exciting company. And I'm actually a lead investor in that. I'm also on the board of that company. And last one, I guess I'll talk about is a company called CyberDontics. And so this is a medical robotics company. And if someone who's been unfortunate enough to get a root canal knows that it's a pretty ardent and long process. It takes about an hour and a half, 2 hours. And if you actually analyze the time period it takes, it's just getting to it. It's the entire process doesn't require 2 hours of drilling. It's just some processes require multiple hands and things like that. So they're starting with the fact that I think there's a space where a robotic arm in the dental space is ripe for disruption. But the thing that has prohibited I think, in my opinion, medical robotics to come into dental space is the three-dimensional view of the stuff. And so you look at Da Vinci robots, which, as some of the listeners may or may not be aware, which is doing robotic surgeries in the space of prostate, in very non sort of areas where you know it's doing it very precisely and very accurately, and it's deployed at many hospitals around the world. But in dental space, you don't see much, and the reason is you don't have three-dimensional view of the tooth. We're still relying on X-rays. And the thing is, to get a three-dimensional view of the tooth, you're also in dental practices are not going to invest in a pretty intense and expensive equipment of MRI and things like that. So first step, they have developed this sort of three-dimensional view technology called based on OCT, which builds the three-dimensional view of the tooth accurately at a low cost. And now with that technology, they have a robotic arm that can do, which will aim to do surgery, sort of these dental procedures like root canal under 15 to 20 minutes. So two things come out of this. One is, I think it's going to be a better experience and accuracy. The second will be dental practices can see a lot more patients. And third, when a patient is shown a three-dimensional view of the tooth, it's very easy to see that this is a procedure or follow-up I need to do. One of the stats that the founder shared with me, this is part of a study, is that 70 to 80% of the folks who need these kind of procedures don't come back because they just don't see it. They are shown two-dimensional view of the tooth, which hardly you can tell anything. But if you can see the three-dimensional view and the damage, I think it also helps patients kind of see that. So anyways, these are some of the thought processes on why we ended up going after some of these bolder ideas, yet I think could be transformational technologies.
Yeah, well, each of these companies sounds super interesting and doing, you know, something different. And I think just listening to you describe them, I related to some of the challenges that you just described. So that makes a lot of sense. Well, I guess just to wrap up our conversation, I think I'd like to zoom out on the more, you know, Texas and Houston VC scene. I know you've worked on the coast and you're here in Houston and a lot of your LPs are here in Texas. So what's been your observation on Houston's VC scene? Has it made some movement over the years? Is there progress to be made still? What's your point of view?
Yeah, I think Houston, the startup scene, the ecosystem and the venture, it's come a long way. Especially, I really think the med tech, the biotech spaces is improving quite a bit, and it's actually becoming very attractive. You have the TMC accelerators and TMC, which is, you know, as you know, largest hospital system. So it kind of pulls folks here because you have that sort of ecosystem. You have J Labs, which I hear is the largest of its kind in the United States. You have Ion and sort of these setup that just didn't exist a few years ago. And then you have Rice University of Houston, and some investments coming in here. So I think it's started to become a pretty decent hub because there's right talent, there's some capital that's available, and there's incubators and spaces available. I think for general tech, I think Austin kind of leading that pack, so to speak, where you know, I think generally the talent and the startups tend to be there. So I think Houston, probably, if you were to ask me, can really be established themselves as a biotech hub or tech bio hub, if in that sense, where it could be attractive for founders to come in founder space, the cost of living, and the talent, and then, you know, being around the best cancer hospital in the world. You have the largest hospital systems in the world. You have TMC, Memorial. So I can see why this has become a decent hub and starting to become even bigger.
Absolutely. A lot to keep an eye on for sure. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It was a pleasure getting to know you and Rhodey Ventures. I think I'm going to be thinking about a lot of these different technologies and tech bio and biotech differently after this conversation. So I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for hosting me. It was a great conversation, and you know, I'll continue to I've heard a few podcasts of yours, and they're very interesting conversations. And so, it's my pleasure to be part of this conversation.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.